Welcome to the 9G's podcast, an aviation podcast, episode number 10. Today, episode special guest is John Rain Waters. Rain is a former United States Air Force fighter pilot. He served as a T-62 first assignment instructor pilot, a King Air pilot, and ultimately an F-16 pilot. During his time in the Air Force, Rain flew 128 combat missions during Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Inherent Resolve. Rain's final flying assignment in the Air Force was the commander and pilot of the Air Combat Command's F-16 Viper demo team. He now flies on the Boeing 777 for a major cargo carrier in North America. He's as well the host of the Afterburn podcast. Rain, thank you very much for joining me on the 9G's podcast. It's a real pleasure having you here.
Oh, I'm honored to be here. Thank you for having me on. I'm excited to chat a little bit.
Yeah, and it's pretty amazing because we are currently at the exactly opposite side of the world. I'm recording from Hong Kong. You're recording from Atlanta. And that's the first time for me. It's 9 p.m. here and 9 a.m. in Atlanta, right?
Yeah, I would say it's a first for me as well. And I think it is a testament to just how amazing technology is and what it's done to close the gap across the globe.
Yeah, exactly. So you're recording from Atlanta. That's where you grown up?
It is, yeah. I grew up in Atlanta. Obviously, I left a little bit when I was in the Air Force, bounced around just a little bit. And then ultimately, when I decided to leave active duty, and that's where the family and I decided to settle down. So I grew up in an aviation community. A lot of the guys who were around me, a lot of my friends' dads, they all flew for Delta Airlines, but they all had a military background. My father saw that as a career that might be something I'd be interested in and initially nudged me in the direction to ask more questions and find out more about it. At about 14, 15, I actually flew in a Piper Cub on a beautiful day. The door opened and that was the initial aviation hook. And then September 10th, 2001 was my first flight for my private pilot's license. Obviously, the next day was a moment that changed the world and what it looks like today. And it solidified my fact that not only did I want to fly, but I also wanted to serve my country.
Yeah. How many flying hours did you have before just to enroll in the Air Force?
I had roughly 100 hours going into the Air Force. Some of that was, I'd say probably 80% of that was on my own. And then the Air Force actually will put you in a small plane after you're awarded a pilot slot as an initial screening. So I think I got another 20 hours in light general aviation aircraft, DA-20 as what we were flying from there. Now I'm back on the other side of it, which is kind of interesting.
So you joined the United States Air Force Academy, or did you do something else?
So I did ROTC, Reserve Officer Training Corps. And the way it's set up for our Air Force is we partner with universities and we'll have Air Force officers assigned to that university. And when you do ROTC, you have a couple classes a week that you'll do that's Air Force focused. And so I went to Georgia Tech right here in Atlanta and did ROTC. And after 4 years, graduated and then the next day commissioned into the Air Force.
Okay. And what's the basic training in the United States Air Force to become a fighter pilot?
So for ROTC, you'll spend 4 years obviously going through school. And again, like I alluded to, one or two events a week, but in between your summer break, so between May and August when school starts back up, you usually have a four-week program every summer that's tied to some kind of military training. But once you go into the Air Force, once you've graduated college and earned your commission, that's when you're going to go do your job. And for me, it was being a pilot. I actually went down to Moody Air Force Base in South Georgia and I waited to go to pilot training for a little over a year, in which my job was purely just to learn how to be an Air Force officer. I was assigned to a helicopter rescue squadron. So I got to see that mission, which was really unique and really, it was a really cool experience. And then I finally went to pilot training, which at the time was about a year, and the Air Force is rapidly evolving and they're already talking about cutting pilot training in half. So we'll see what it becomes. But that is essentially the initial steps becoming a fighter pilot is getting to pilot training, graduating pilot training. Once you're awarded a fighter, you tack on another 6 weeks of introduction to fighter fundamentals, just basic fighter maneuvers, surface attack, and a T-38, mm-hmm. and then you'll move on to your major weapon system. In my case, the F-16, which is about a 9-month additional training program. And so you'll learn how to fly the F-16, how to hit the buttons and employ the weapons, and then you'll finally move on to your fighter squadron to learn out how to actually fly tactically.
Yeah, okay. Your first assignment was an F-16?
So my first assignment, I actually, after pilot training, I stayed there and I taught. So as you alluded to in the opening, that was a first assignment instructor pilot in the T-6. So after graduation, I actually went to pilot instructor training in the T-6 out of Randolph Air Force Base in Texas. I came back to Columbus, Mississippi, where I went through pilot training, and I spent 3 years there teaching new students how to fly the T-6.
Yeah, it's pretty rough when you've just been graduated fighter pilot, and then you have to go and spending 3 years instructing. You just want to be in a fighter, and you have to instruct during 3 years.
Yeah, undoubtedly. You definitely see students who go on and they're getting into the fight, and you're just like, I want to go do that. That's why I signed up. That's why I wanted to be a fighter pilot. In my mind, I saw Afghanistan wrapping up and Iraq wrapping up, and I was like, well, I'll never get to do what I thought, you know, I joined to do. And turned out not the case, but nonetheless, like, it is one of those things when you graduate pilot training, you just want to get out there and do it. So when you come back and you have to teach, it definitely is a little bit of a slowdown, I'll say, but I really enjoyed the assignment. Teaching is very rewarding, and I would definitely go back and do it again. Maybe not my first assignment. I don't know. Maybe I would do it. I don't know. In the end, I really did enjoy that assignment.
Yeah, it's pretty strange. We have the same in the French Air Force. Sometimes we have guys just graduated, you know, that goes directly to be instructors in a single engine aircraft, single propeller aircraft. And that's a bit of strange. And sometimes some guys don't go back, you know, in the forces and don't go back in the operational squadrons because they don't have the motivation anymore. I don't know if it happens to one of you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are some people, Air Education Training Command is where all that lies for us. And so there are definitely people that go there and then they really like the quality of life it provides. I mean, most of those guys are home every single night and they might go on a temporary duty assignment once a year. And so it definitely is I would say it's still a very busy pace. I remember those days, you're still 12-hour days. So it's not like it's easy work, but at the end of the day, you're always going to go home for the most part and sleep in your bed. Yeah. Which is kind of nice. So we definitely get guys who go there and then they stay.
Yeah, and especially I think they get married, they have the first kid, they buy the house, and then they say, yeah, it's very comfortable. I just don't want to move away from that. And in the other parts as well, it's good to be able to see an instruct before going in the operational squadrons because you'll be able to have a kind of step back and perhaps you gain a bit of maturity.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a lot of benefit. Airmanship, that's what I equate it to, yeah. Is you show up to a squadron and I think you have a lot more airmanship. I definitely didn't have the tactical knowledge of the F-16 like someone who'd been flying it for 3 years, but I definitely think there were scenarios I found myself in as a wingman, but older than the flight lead, where they might not think of just, I don't know, some basic things like fuel or weather, because they hadn't been painted into a corner before where they were going to run into a situation that was going to be tough to recover from, or it was going to make it a little bit more challenging to get through that sortie. And again, not saying I had all the answers by any stretch of the means, but I definitely think there was some benefit of showing up, you know, with 1,000+ hours already under my belt flying Air Force planes to the F-16. Granted, it is built to show up right out of pilot training and go fly the F-16. And you have to learn those. I think lessons, just they're a little bit more expensive to learn than flying the T-6. So there are trade-offs with everything.
Yeah. And you've done a bit of King Air after the T-6. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. So the King Air was a unique experience. It was something that evolved rapidly in the U.S. Air Force because we saw a need for more Predator or unmanned aerial vehicle combat air patrols over Afghanistan and Iraq, mm-hmm. and we couldn't make them fast enough or the crews fast enough. So taking an off-the-shelf product such as the King Air and taking off-the-shelf technology and throwing that technology in the King Air was a solution to help provide ground forces in Afghanistan and Iraq the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance that they so desperately needed. So the Air Force took this program and in a matter of 6 months stood it up, which I think you probably can attest to. Anything government moving that fast is impressive. But we took crews all across the Air Force and we trained people to go fly the King Air. And then we also took people to run full motion video sensors as well as do some cryptological operations in the back of the plane, put this 4-person crew together and then go out there and operate. And so it was a piecemeal group. We had people, our flow through group. So we had every weapon system in the Air Force represented flying MC-12s, anything from the F-22 to the C-17, C-130. And so it was a 6-month assignment. And it was, again, it was beneficial, I think, for me, especially later on, like in Operation Inherent Resolve, understanding the intelligence, mm-hmm. surveillance, and reconnaissance world and how those platforms operate to make the fight more effective. Knowing that, you know, or one of these type aircraft flying around Iraq has 4 people sitting in it, all looking at HD TV screens with very high resolution versus me and my F-16 with a relatively low resolution screen, flying formation in the weather at night on MVGs, who is trying to figure out, you know, all sorts of things. It's nice to know, like, hey, we can utilize them as a very, you know, valuable tool to help enhance our situational awareness for this whole fight. So it was definitely a unique experience, and I'm glad I did it. It was good to do a touch and go there and off into other things, but it's a whole nother world for me.
Yeah, I think you were happy as well to go finally flying the F-16.
So actually, I did the T-6 assignment, and in the middle of that, I did my MC-12 deployment. And right when I came back from that deployment in 2012, in August, that's when I found out I was going to go to the F-16. So I still had a few months to clean up and wrap up my T-6 assignment. And in January of 2013 is when I started my spin-up for Introduction to Fighter Fundamentals. And then in May of 2013, I moved out to Luke Air Force Base in Arizona to start F-16 training.
Okay, great. So 2013. Then I think you've done all your F-16 training. Then you deployed in Afghanistan. It was back in 2015, 2014.
Yeah, so actually that deployment, and so 2012 was Afghanistan, and then 2014-15 was in support of Operation Inherent Resolve. So mostly flying around Iraq and Syria. But I had finished my F-16 training and showed up to my squadron, and ISIS wasn't even a thing.
Yeah.
But about 2 months into it, that's when ISIS popped up on the map and everything kind of changed for us and our spin up. So it got really busy to get ready to go out the door for that fight. I think even when we showed up, I don't think Operation Inherent Resolve had even been named yet. I think it still was just some kind of support mission or something like that.
Yeah. So you were deployed in Iraq, so in F-16. So you were flying only the King Air in Afghanistan, right?
Correct. Yeah. So that's the only time I got to putz around slow overseas, I guess.
Yeah. The main missions in Iraq, I think, was close air support or some air interdiction. Can you tell us a bit about the operation you flew in?
Yeah. So it was a mix of everything. And like I said, you know, ISIS was it was a new thing. And I think everyone kind of can remember they were taking over that whole region and they were doing it incredibly fast. So the mission just rapidly evolved for us. And it was also dynamic because we're flying around Iraq and Syria, and Syria obviously has an established government, civil war going on, but they have fighter aircraft, their neighbors to the north. There's lots of tensions. The Russians got involved while we were there too. So the dynamics were quite unique. I think we were doing some things that we never thought we would do again. But the missions varied, but predominantly providing close air support. And it was providing close air support to the YPG, to just locating anything that might be ISIL related and eradicating it. So a typical sortie might look like 4 to 8 hours, just depending on where you're going. And again, we would take off and we would support missions all across Iraq and Syria. And you're just working for guys and gals on the ground that are literally fighting inch by inch, trying to get rid of ISIS.
Yeah. And do you remember your first mission of flying the F-16 in Iraq?
Yeah, I think it was a night. So I was on the night train, as we call it. It was a night sortie. Yeah. So it took off and we were flying up the western edge of Iraq, getting hooked up to the tanker. Obviously, there's a lot of things going on. I remember it was a pain to get hooked up to the tanker. And then we went over to Kobani, Syria, which at the time was a big focal point for all of our operations because it's right on the border of Turkey and ISIS had a stronghold. And we showed up, and again, I think everyone had been used to the very close control that had happened in Iraq version 2, whatever you want to call it, as well as Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. It's very restrictive. And we literally had a map of the town with sectors, and there was one sector that was green. So if we had to drop anything in there, we had to talk to someone. Anything outside of that sector, if it was a person, if it was a vehicle, if it was any kind of piece of equipment, we were to destroy it.
It's kind of kill box.
Yeah. And it was crazy. You know, I mean, that's, I don't think anyone really kind of envisioned going back to that type of freedom for flight leads to make decisions to employ weapons without talking to a joint terminal attack controller or talking to anyone for that matter. And so the first sortie I employed on a couple of vehicles, and then right at the end of it, we actually, again, it just kind of shows how different it was doing a combined simultaneous attack with two other F-16s and two Strike Eagles. And we were running south to north, right, you know, right up against the Turkish border, which you can't cross, and all trying to have weapons impact within 1 second on the street that was just filled with ISIS. So it was really dynamic and unique to put all this together, these different platforms on the first combat sortie. I think on my last pass, I ended up having a hung weapon. So, you know, it was the first time for that too. So it was, you know, the adrenaline's pumping and then, you know, one bomb doesn't come off, and it was interesting, but yeah.
Murphy Law.
Yeah.
Everything, unknowns.
Yeah. Everything that can go wrong will go wrong.
What was your mindset at that time?
I would say excited, you know, again, like walking out the door to deploy. That was
finally, hey, you're here.
Yeah. Finally, we're going to go do what I signed up. So it was such a long road. And then to be able to go out there and do it, especially, I think, you know, like taking a human life obviously is a very serious matter. Even if it is ISIS, like you don't just do it, by happen chance, like there's a lot that goes involved into it. But I definitely saw what, and I think everyone else did too, what ISIS was doing and how barbaric. And so being able to, in my mind, make the world a little bit better place and ensure that people have safety and security from these heinous acts was, you know, a humbling piece of it. And so you take it very seriously, but definitely the adrenaline was up to go out there and do the job right. And just fortunate to be able to have some kind of impact on, I think, making society just a little bit better.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And then finally you came back in the US, and you were lucky enough to be able to fly the F-16 as a demo pilot.
Yeah, absolutely. So like you said, I'm very fortunate that I had that opportunity, because for me, it was just icing on the cake, right? I was fortunate to be able to do pretty much everything I wanted to do in the Air Force or that I signed up to do. And then being able to do the demo was, again, icing on the cake for me. I never really considered it. In fact, the F-16 demo team had stopped flying in 2012, 2013, when we had sequestration, we were drawing down and didn't have all this government funding. But while we were deployed in 2014-15, the Air Force stood the demo team back up. So I really never even considered it as being a possibility. But when I came back, I saw the demo being flown at Shaw. I thought, hey, that was kind of cool. But it wasn't until we had an air show in 2016 that I even considered it because I ran across one of my buddies who was on the Thunderbirds and talked to him about the airshow world a little bit. And then luck would have it, a week later, they put out a message asking for volunteers to submit applications to be the next demo pilot. So again, fortuitous, I applied. And the process for the F-16, at least, is pretty much centralized to our base in South Carolina. But they'll put out a call, you submit an application, obviously they look and review all your records, and it kind of moves up the chain as far as who they're going to select, and they'll do a few interviews. The Raptors, for instance, will do a little bit different because they share their airplanes. So they'll put a call out for every F-22 pilot in the system to apply. So it just kind of depends. But I was fortunate enough to be selected for the upgrade process. It's about, I think it's like 20 rides, which is quite a few as far as doing upgrades in the F-16. Yeah. But most of the sorties are like 15 minutes. So you just don't have a lot of time to do it. And it's just one demonstration in that 15 minute window. That's all the gas you have. So you get a few reps, but started training in December of 2016 and completed that training in February of 2017. And with that comes several checkouts. So at first you're flying at 5,000 feet, then 2,000 feet, then 1,000 feet, and then 500, and then 300 is eventually your target altitude for most of the maneuvers. But you'll get checked out by your first 06 in the chain of command, which is a colonel, the operations group commander who owns all the flying assets and all the pilots at the base. He'll check you out, and then you'll get checked out by the wing commander who owns every asset on the base. And then there's a two-star general who will review, come out and watch your performance. You'll meet with him. And then finally, there's a four-star, the commander of Air Combat Command, will do your final review. So there's a lot of visibility that goes into it. And they want to make sure that, one, you know you're supported, so you can always say, no, I'm not going to do that because it's not safe when you're out at an air show.
Yeah.
And two, so that you know, don't go out there and, you know, shine your butt and make some stupid mistake and end up killing yourself or killing other people. So it's quite a lengthy process to get checked out. Another facet of it is we fly with warbirds. So we do an annual training out in Tucson, Arizona, the Heritage Flight Training Conference. And there's 10 civilian pilots that are checked out to fly along with Air Combat Command assets. So the Raptor, the Lightning, the Viper, the Hog. And so there's a lot that goes into flying an F-16 demo. But then I think the challenge is the last maneuver of the profile is about 9.5 G's for 8 seconds. So you've really been trying to rip the wings off for the past 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going 600 plus knots, and you're going to rejoin with a P-51 that's flying around at 220 knots, 230 knots. So you're 3 feet from this priceless warbird that doesn't have an ejection seat. So it's quite a unique process to go through all that training and bring it all together in a matter of 3 months.
Yeah, I can imagine. It should be as well very, very nice to be able to fly with those warbirds.
Yeah, no doubt. I fell in love with the P-51 as a kid. You know, my grandfather was a gunner on a B-17 during World War II. And so obviously there's a lot that goes into, you know, the P-51 kind of turning the tides of the war for all of us. But the cool part for me was, you know, after especially that first sortie out at Tucson flying with the warbirds, I did my demonstration, the adrenaline is up, rejoin on the Mustang, and you just have to kind of take a second to pull yourself back and process how amazing this is flying alongside the 70-year-old warbird. But the cool part in the F-16, you actually can hear that Merlin motor, and despite the double ear protection, the canopy and everything like that. So it's pretty cool and pretty humbling.
Yeah, it's very amazing. I think it's the dream of a lot of fighter pilots to be able to join one of those birds from the B-24 to P-51 or Spitfire or whatever. It's kind of piece of history that you're joining up.
Yeah, it's incredible that, one, these planes are still flying. It's awesome that people have the money to keep them going and maintain them, because obviously it's not cheap, but I wholeheartedly agree. Like it's a fabric of all of our air forces as far as what those planes mean, what they did, what those pilots were able to accomplish. World War II and on, you know, specifically. And so to see them flying is incredible, but let alone to be able to fly on one of their wings is just, it's awesome.
Coming back on your training and on the air show that you've done for 1 year block, what's the number of your air show you're supposed to fly?
So typically the schedule is around 20 air shows a year. And I'll say for my 2.5 years doing it, that always changed. We typically did anywhere from 25. We did around 25 air shows, it seemed like. And then we typically added on a few more flyovers and various other trips or events that we would support.
And so you're a full-time demo pilot at the time. You don't have any training assignment or you don't have any operational assignments. So it's a full-time and you have your own squadron?
Yeah. So the deal is that is your only duty. It changed, I think, in around the 2003 time period, where we realized that it's just too much to do both because of the currency and the requirement just to be proficient in the demonstration, as well as all the requirements to do the tactical stuff. It's just too much. Now, that being said, still could fly with the squadron to do tactical sorties, and I actually maintain a mission check ride and some kind of tactical event. I was definitely not proficient by any stretch of the means. So if there was a surge week where we're really ramping up the flying, I would try to fly some kind of tactical sortie just to at least stay somewhat, you know, current, if you will. And I use hard air quotes on current, because if you're only doing something tactical once a month, even, you're not going to be very good at it.
Yeah, you take your long range and then you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you do during your the winter season? I mean, obviously you don't fly in the air show. You just train to be able to compete and to be able to be fit flying the air shows the next year.
Yeah, exactly. I would typically target to fly the demonstration twice a week, if not three times. But what I really spent the off season doing, especially after my first season, you know, we're fortunate in the F-16 community to still have, again, this is the only time I'll say it's fortunate, to have D models, so 2-seat variants. No one ever wants to fly with another person in the jet. But in this case, it was beneficial because it could actually put people in the back seat and put them through the demo profile. So I would, my practices over the field, I would typically put one of my safety observers. So there's 6 pilots that are designated to go with you as your wingman to the air shows. And they're going to be the guy or gal on the ground that's going to back you up in the checklist when you are at small city X, Y, or Z, nowhere near anything military. So put the safety observers for the profile so they can appreciate the demanding, you know, just how demanding the sortie is. And then if they're not a pilot, I can still fly them, but we couldn't do the demonstration at the demonstration altitude. So yeah, so we actually had an airspace that was just right off the field, which was perfect for this. Based on just having no gas and the D model and how gas hungry the profile is. But I spent a lot of time flying our maintainers. So that piece was really rewarding because they're the ones that make it happen, right? Like, I think you and I can attest, like, I can flip a couple switches and take off and land, but I can only do that a couple times before you're really going to need maintenance. That's if everything's going well, you know, but those guys and gals turning the wrenches made it happen. So in the off season, I spent a lot of time flying our maintainers. I think it all said and done, I flew around like 80 plus familiarization rides. So 80 plus sorties with someone in my backseat, which I don't know if is a record, but it's definitely a lot of backseat riders just ringing them out.
And I think they deserve it. You know, the mechanics and all the guys that make it happen. It's very nice. I was able as well to do some FAM flights for the engineers of the French Air Force. And yeah, that's nice to be able to share the step after, you know, the departing aircraft, because they only see the aircraft departing and the aircraft arriving. They work a lot between the two sorties, but they don't know what happens next. Yeah. And it's very rewarding to have them flying, and especially flying the F-16 and with the demo pilot. I think it should be very full of lessons learned for them.
You know, I was fortunate. I think that's kind of the best part of my experience doing the demo, was having the team of maintainers and kind of being our own squadron. Because obviously, like any team, you get pretty close-knit. And once you start figuring out how to work well together, like, it's off to the races. And the the awesome aspect for the demo for maintainers, I think, is they're tied directly to that mission. So, and they can see it all happen. So from takeoff to landing, they all know the profile. They know when I mess something up. Those guys were fully ingrained and they took it really personal when something would break, if I had to go to a spare, or if during the demonstration something happened that was maintenance related. You could see, you know, them wanting the mission to succeed, which is, it's tougher to do on the line when, like you said, you fly, the jet flies twice a day, they're going to turn it. But when that jet taxis out of the chalks, they don't see it again for another 2 hours. They might not see it for another 6 hours. And they don't really, if something goes wrong in the air, I know they take it personal, but they don't see it. You know, it's not that immediate impact versus the demo. When something goes wrong, I mean, they're standing right there as part of the crowd watching it. So they take it very personal.
Yeah, you're right. I was lucky enough to be able to fly a short tactical demo for one of the air show that we've done in France in 2019. And the relationship with the maintainers, yeah, that was amazing. And they take it personal. And I think regardless the nationality, regardless the language they speak, it's always the same. When they can see and the result directly in front of them, yeah, it's very rewarding for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it probably ties to really everyone. You know, it's very easy to see how important what you're doing is if you can see the immediate result. And one thing, I think a number that gets thrown around, at least for us, is on average, it probably takes 750 airmen to put a pilot in the seat to go fly a combat mission, right? And that includes from the security forces guarding the gate to the cooks feeding the maintainers. You know, I mean, it's everyone. It's a huge operation and everyone has to do their part. But for some people, they're so far removed from it, they don't understand that when they don't do their job, the ramifications that it has further down the chain. And they really just have to buy into the I believe type deal unless they're able to see the mission impact. And I can say that's one testament to the leadership we had at Shaw. Was a big push to kind of showcase, hey, this is what, when this jet goes out on a sortie, this is what it's doing. And this is how you play into the mission and how important you are, because it takes a team to make it all happen.
Yeah, exactly. What was the most difficult part flying your demo?
You know, it's a high G sortie and it's all compact. It's probably the just overall difficulty of it. So, you know, I think on average, I burned anywhere from 300 to 600 calories in about 15 minutes. I'm not like a CrossFitter or crazy insane fit guy, but it's definitely very physically demanding. So just rapid G onset, and you can see it. Obviously, you get used to it as you go through it. But when I flew other pilots in the backseat, I think I wouldn't say like it's not terrible, right? But when you're doing that over and over again, or you're doing it and it's 110 degrees out on the ramp and you've been outside all day long because you're in an air show, then getting your mind right, getting your body right to go out there and fly that demanding sortie is definitely a challenge, and you have to be cognizant of it and cognizant of your environment.
Yeah, doing that over and over, that should be very tiring.
Yeah, I think my neck and back definitely feel it for sure.
Oh yeah, every neck and back of fighter pilots at the end of the career, I think it's pretty toned. Then finally, you left the Air Force and you went to the commercial aviation. Can you tell us a bit about that? When did you take your decision to go to the commercial aviation? And how did you prepare to the assessments?
So it was honestly kind of a late decision, I think, for me. I went back and forth as far as I was going to stay or if I was going to go in the Air Force. And it comes down to a family decision. You know, the Air Force was great. I would absolutely go, if I could do it again, I would absolutely go back and do it all over. But it's very demanding. I missed the birth of our son. You know, so there's some big sacrifices we made, and looking at what the next 8 years, at least in my career, look like, is going to be a lot of moving around and a lot of sacrifices on the family for me to be able to keep doing what I wanted to do, which we would have done. But I looked at all the options, and for me, going to the commercial aviation side, being able to move back to our hometown and kind of settle down was a huge family win, and I think the smart play for us. So Made the decision that was going to be it. So I started putting in applications to major airlines. One thing I had to do was get my airline transport pilot, my ATP done. So I actually went out and knocked that out the day after my last F-16 flight. I went out and I always joked like there's no plan B. So my plan A, once I decided upon, I was like, all right, I'm getting out and I'm going to fly big old planes. And I really wanted to fly cargo and one specific company in particular. So that's where I focused all my energy. And again, it was kind of late in the game. I wouldn't recommend people to follow my path. If they want to do it, you could definitely lead turn it a little bit more than I did. But I got out of the Air Force. My last day was in like July 2nd of 2019. And then I had an interview set up on, I think it was July 30th. So again, I was very fortunate, like thread the needle as far as making all this happen, because I had my, as I didn't mention, I got my ATP like on June 19th and submitted my application that day. So yeah, I definitely like was threading the needle. I had a little bit of leave built up with Air Force where I was still on their payroll till October.
It's perfect timing, man.
Yeah. I mean, again, thread the needle. I wouldn't recommend doing it because it definitely came the stress as far as making sure everything worked out. But when I landed, you know, I was fortunate to be offered the position at the company. The training piece of it, and it's probably similar to kind of what you're experiencing and gone through. It's a whole nother world than flying fighters. So the 777 is a big old plane. I think my last trip, I landed weighing 566,000 pounds. And my heaviest takeoff was like 723,000 pounds. So it is just it's another world compared to flying fighters. Like you're worried about the takeoff and the landing. Once you get it airborne, then it's, you know, autopilot on at whatever altitude you use.
And you're worried about the meal once airborne.
Yeah, honestly, the first thing is like, how do you work this oven? You got 14 hours of going from wherever to what's next, you know? So you got to know how to work the oven.
Yeah, exactly. So you're flying cargo planes right now. Can you just tell us a bit about your current job? What's flying cargo planes? What's the specificity of your schedule? Because I think you're flying a lot by night.
Yeah, so typically, like thus far, because with all the COVID-19 stuff going on, the whole world is I think it's changing. So we're really busy in the cargo world, the point where I'm very junior at the company, where I think I normally would be sitting reserve, just waiting to get called out. I've been flying a bunch. And so those typically look like a 2-week trip once a month. But I'll have 2 weeks of flying and then maybe 3 or 4 weeks off, depending on where the next 2-week trip falls in the schedule. But leave the United States and we'll literally go all the way around the world. So maybe go Paris to Dubai to China, bounce around Asia and then to the West Coast of the United States and then back. Or like this last trip, I went England, Paris, Dubai, Singapore, Sydney, China, Cologne, back to the United States. So it just kind of depends, but we're flying a bunch. Flying the 777 for me, again, it's not something that I didn't ever think I would be doing, but it's impressive to see the engineering that has gone into that plane. And just how well and intuitive it is, especially for a guy like me. But it is an impressive plane. They made it very easy to fly. And when, you know, what's mind boggling to me is you have this plane that weighs over 500,000 pounds and it's gusty, it's a wet runway. And it lands, I mean, in my mind, kind of like a Cessna almost. Like it's very intuitive feel to it. And you're landing on an 8,000 foot runway, and you know, an F-16, 8,000 foot is the min runway. And so you're going to be Johnny on the spot, make sure you don't mess anything up. You're on speed. And if the runway's wet and you're heavy, yeah, maybe you're going somewhere else. So it's just crazy to see the differences in these two planes.
Yeah, I think there is a major difference between the Boeing philosophy and the Airbus philosophy. Yeah, that's not the same. You don't fly an Airbus like a Cessna.
Yeah. I actually did my ATP in an Airbus, which I like the side stick. I did the A320, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, because I think it reminds you of the F-16 a lot.
Yeah. I will say bouncing and doing the training, we would do left and right seat. You know, you'd swap with your sim partner. And I was like, I don't know if I'm being able to fly this thing with my left hand, but in the end it was pretty intuitive. But you know, you're just used to right side stick.
Yeah, the roll rate is not very impressive.
Yeah, no, yeah, it's slightly different, right?
Yeah, exactly. So you're flying cargo right now at the Boeing 777. What's next for you?
I don't know. We'll see. Obviously, I'm going to keep flying the 777, I think, for the near future. But it'd be awesome to kind of keep growing. I want to get back into general aviation. That's definitely a passion I have. And to be able to share that. I had a lot of mentors growing up that helped guide me along the way. So I think ultimately, it's all about making someone else better, help improve the quality of life for someone else. So with the passion of aviation and that, hopefully I can merge those two eventually, where I can help, you know, high schoolers out or younger kind of find the spark and interest in aviation and grow into it. So we'll see what it brings. But, you know, first and foremost is taking care of the family. And then the next would be how to make things better.
Yeah, right. So I've mentioned it during the introduction, but you run a podcast that's called the Afterburn Podcast. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate it. Yeah. So I started the Afterburn Podcast kind of along those lines of trying to help people and make things better. You know, again, you and I can attestment, we run across a lot of amazing people in just a short period of time in the military. The air show world was just an amplification of that for me. And so we all have stories and everyone can resonate with other people's stories. And there might be something out there that someone has that if they share might inspire or might help someone get through. So I thought bringing people together in a podcast format would be a beneficial way to help share those stories. And then hopefully it inspires someone, it helps someone get through some adversity or push themselves to the next level. So it's kind of a wide range from military to civilian aviators, as well as non-aviators. I had Caleb Brewer on episode number 8, and this guy stepped on a pressure plate IED in Afghanistan and lost both his legs, one above the knee, one below the knee. And I met him while doing air shows, of all things, when some people took me out for surfing lessons. And I was flailing, just trying to figure this out. And Caleb's over there surfing. Obviously, I have an advantage over Caleb, but seeing him do that was a huge inspiration to me. And so having guys like Caleb on the podcast to share their stories where they could easily give up or say, poor, pitiful me, but instead they've spun it around and going out conquering life, I think are very valuable people to get their message out to the world.
Yeah, sure. Talking about message, do you have any advice for the youngsters wanting to become fighter pilot or commercial pilot?
Yeah, absolutely. I think with anything, one, it's just finding a passion in life, and people find it at different points, but finding something you're passionate about and then getting after it. You have to know what those requirements are for what you want to go do. For me, it was aviation. So if there's someone listening that that's what they want to do, you got to find out what their requirements are in order to go meet your goal. If it's military aviation or if it's civilian aviation, what's the desired end state and how do you get there? Knowing that there are other people that have walked the path before you is huge. And so you can rely on mentors to help guide you, right? Know how to utilize their time. So if it's something you can figure out on your own, then figure it out on your own. If it's not, then by all means, like, ask. But I think the biggest thing is just finding that passion, finding out what their requirements are, and then getting after it is the biggest thing. Because it happens fast. Like, I feel like just yesterday, I was in high school just trying to get into college to go pursue ROTC, you know, and a snap of the fingers, my Air Force career has zipped by and now I'm flying big old planes around. So it happens fast. And if you wait to get after it, it's going to be too late.
Yeah, just seize the opportunity when you can.
Absolutely.
Great. Rain, thank you very much for joining me on the 90s podcast. It was a real pleasure having you.
Hey, I thank you for having me on here. It's exciting. I think it's really a testament just how cool things are. The fact that we're on opposite sides of the world able to do this. So hopefully we can high five and share a beer here in the near future.
You've been listening to the 90s podcast, an aviation podcast. If you liked this show, subscribe and share on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all the podcast platforms, including YouTube. You can as well follow us on Instagram and Facebook on the 90s Podcast account. Thanks again for listening.